Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Mr. Andy Bell. Hey Andy.
Hey Alex, how you doing?
Yeah.
Nice to see you.
Good, how you doing?
I'm good. I've been enjoying off air listening to some of your stories about your adventures over there in the other side of the world, and I must say I'm a little bit jealous. So congratulations for taking the leap and going over. It sounds like you're having a ball.
No, thank you so much. No, it's really good. But today's episode, I'm really excited to talk to you about, because we had a listener pop in a question, which kind of made me think sort of more broadly in terms of how we could tackle some extra topics. And the main question, I guess, or topic that was brought up was sort of getting uncertainty and anxiousness of getting a job to arriving on scene. So when you get that job come through on your monitors, you're in the ambulance, and then sort of mulling through that as you get to the job. And I thought, how on earth do we tackle this sort of topic? And I thought potentially going into more of that sort of training and preparedness side, and I thought, who best to bring on? And I thought of you, Andy. We've talked before on this podcast, but for those that are new, I'd love for you to sort of tell me a little bit more about yourself.
Well, firstly, thank you. I'm super interested in that question, and there's a lot of places for us to go down the rabbit hole on that one. So, let's put a flag in that and we'll come back. But just, very quickly, my name's Andy. I'm a paramedic, have been for about 16 or 17 odd years now, worked in jurisdictional service. I've also taught in a number of different universities, and currently I'm employed as a senior lecturer at Griffith, but most recently have taken a full-time role as the paramedic team leader for an organisation group called TACMED, which works predominantly in the tactical medical space. Obviously, that has a high threat and austere environment component to it, which is an area that we train specifically for. And I've worked with a number of, special forces groups and things like that, working on their ability to operate in those types of environments. And I'm also lucky enough to be a part of some really fantastic research groups looking at things like physiological and psychological stress nexus and how we respond to stress. So the question that you've brought to us today is really something that is of the utmost interest to me. So I'm really interested to jump in, and let's see where we go with it, hey?
That's awesome. Well, as I said, you're the best person for this, so we'll jump in. You can't avoid getting anxiety or nerves before a job in a way, and I guess more so it's how you prepare for it. So where do we start in trying to make sort of that, I guess, anxiety or unease towards a job a bit more positive or beneficial for the case that you're going to? And I guess that starts with training. So I guess the first question to start this is, how do we use our training, or how can we better use our training to sort of prepare ourselves a lot better when we are going to these scenes?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. So first and foremost, it's really important for everybody listening to understand, whether or not you're the newest novice or the oldest, most experienced head in the game, that the response and the stress response, the sympathetic flight or fright response, is perfectly normal. In fact, it's absolutely normal. We've done a bunch of research in this area, and one of the most interesting things that's come out of it is when we look at the sympathetic physiological response of operators, regardless of their training, regardless of whether or not they're paramedics. We've also worked with, special forces, tactical medics and things like that, is that the highest point of sympathetic response is at the point where they first receive the job. So when that pager goes off, when your phone goes, however it is that you're receiving the information about the job, that is the biggest trigger for that physiological sympathetic, hypersympathetic response. And so because we know that that's going to happen, that gives us an opportunity, because once we, the thing with being able to train for something, anything, is to have an understanding of what it is you're training for. So if you don't know that you are going to get stressed, or if you're ignorant to the fact that you are stressed, and by ignorant, I don't mean that in a negative way. I don't mean that, you know, you're some kind of ignorant person, but rather that you just don't know how stressed you are, then you can't begin to try and determine how I'm going to manage that level of stress. So the first thing we have to get our head around is getting a feeling, getting an understanding of what it feels like to be stressed. Yeah, we need to stress ourselves. I'll put it into maybe, you know, a simple analogy. Let's, you know, I know you love a bit of CrossFit, mate. I know you love to lift a few weights and that's awesome. How do we make a muscle stronger? How do we make it stronger?
You put it under stress.
You put it under stress, progressive overload, right? We put it under stress, and what does it do?
It adapts.
It adapts. Yeah, it adapts. And then what do we do?
We grow. It grows.
It grows. And so then what do?
We keep doing it.
We put it under more stress, and it adapts, and so on and so on. And that's the evolution of our muscle, right? Well, it's the same thing with our stress response. We can evolve our stress response by putting ourselves under it in a controlled manner, of course, because an uncontrolled level of stress is going to lead to things like PTSD, burnout and things. And that is, there's an inherent danger there. And that's what we're trying to inoculate against. This is effectively what we're doing. We're building, you know, almost like a stress vaccine. We're trying to get our body and our mind used to the fact that it's going to redline. It's going to redline. There's no problem with that as long as we understand what that does to our body and what that in turn does to things like our quality of decision making. So we don't want to not stress ourselves. We need to stress ourselves in order to start to adapt to that environment. And the worst thing that you could do is avoid stress altogether, because then when you do get stressed, what happens? What happens to that muscle group? If you don't train for a year and then you go to the gym and you put all the weights on the bar and you try to do a PR bench press the first day back, what happens?
You get injured.
You get injured. You cook yourself. You get crushed under the bar and you become a meme on Instagram or TikTok or something, right? Yeah. So we need to avoid that. So we are trying to build our tolerance to stress. We are effectively building our tolerance. Now, in order to do that, we have to be exposed to it. Again, let's use an analogy that many of our, you know, listeners will be aware of. When it comes to things like becoming tolerant to some form of antigen, we need exposure to it, don't we? Yeah, in order to build that tolerance. We also see tolerance in things like, you know, alcohol. You know, not that I would suggest that this has ever happened to anyone that's listening right now, but, you know, if this was to have happened, imagine casting your mind back to the first time you ever drank alcohol and you had literally one beer or one dodgy vodka, something or other. And the next thing you know, you're all over the shop and your friends are pulling you out of the gutter and you've made a complete fool of yourself. But these days, it takes at least three of those beers or five of those beers or whatever. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that that's what has happened before you find yourself, you know, doing something silly and climbing a flagpole in the middle of whatever. So, again, it's a tolerance thing. We build tolerance over time by exposing ourselves to things in a progressive overload. So in order to do that, we have to find a way to do it in a safe manner. Now, that's where the training comes in. One of the biggest mistakes we see in training, and I see this, I've seen this over and over again, and it's incredibly frustrating, is that people don't necessarily treat training with the respect that it deserves. There's a lot of cliches out there, you know, you'll perform to the level at which you train, you know, all that kind of stuff. If you shoot low, you'll aim, you know, if you aim low, you'll shoot low. There's all these cliches, but they're true, because if you don't train in a manner which forces your body and your mind to know what it feels like to be redlining, to be in that sympathetic response, then when you get to the real thing, it doesn't know what to do. And you will literally melt down and you'll make terrible mistakes and it'll all come unraveled. And you know what? I'd much rather kill a mannequin than a real person. So, you know, put yourself under the pump. The worst thing that you can do, and I know this is a student paramedic podcast, so I'm assuming there'll be, you know, a few students listening to this. The worst thing you can do is feel anxious in one of your lab classes, in one of your tutorials, you know, when you've got your peers around you and go, oh, I'm a little bit anxious. Oh, gee, I don't want to fail in front of my friends. I don't want to look silly in front of everyone. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to find a way to avoid this. And, you know, we've all seen it. You know, they slide to the back of the class. You know, this might be triggering a few people that are listening right now where they're like, I'm just going to hide behind these people here because I don't like this. I don't feel comfortable about it. Exactly. You don't feel comfortable. So you should be doing it. Because if you don't feel comfortable about it in that controlled environment in front of a couple of peers with a plastic mannequin and fake drugs, then how are you going to feel when it is the real thing? And so we need to really step up our game when it comes to building stress within our training models. And one of the things we're seeing more and more now at the higher levels of training, you know, I've been working with, as I said, some special forces groups and people like that. They want to be tested. They want to redline. They want to know what their level is, their peak level is, so that when they find it, they can train for it. And we need to try and get that mindset out into the broader space, into the broader paramedic space, training space, et cetera. So that's just my, I guess, my first thoughts on it. Does that come across and made any sense, or am I, you know, making that up?
It makes a lot of sense. It's really, it's fantastic. And I think there's a lot to unpack there from, I think too, I don't know what your thoughts on this. I know you say like you need to be stressed and sort of redlined, but I mean, when talking about that stress, I guess it's important to note when stress can become too much versus the Yerkes-Dodson inverted U sort of theory of having sort of that U stress or that sort of, you don't want like complete nothing, but you don't want too much. You just need the perfect amount. And I guess from what I'm understanding from what you're saying as well, obviously you need to be able to do that in training, sort of see where you get redlined and practice so that you can sort of develop or adapt into that sort of gaining that sort of normal or that sort of beneficial amount of stress that can positively impact your performance.
Yeah, you're talking about that inverted U theory of optimal arousal, because you know we want to sit at the top of the curve, which is not enough stress and is not too much stress. You know, neither is good. In order to know what that optimal arousal looks like, because we're all different, we all have a different curve. You know, we will all respond differently sympathetically. For example, you know, I might find myself with, you know, heart rates of sort of 150, 160, where you're just cruising along at a nice little 110 in the same situation. It's irrelevant. It's very difficult to compare, you know, an operator to another operator, a paramedic to another paramedic. It should all be that paramedic to themselves, because it's all about how you are responding and what your changes are to that environment. With that in mind, we won't know what that looks like if we've never tested it. You don't know what it looks like to go past your limit until you've gone past your limit. And then you know, okay, cool, there's the line and I know where that is. And I know how I felt when I got there. And that's key. I know how I felt. One of the things that we know is that when somebody is stressed, one of the first things to go is their fine motor skills. All right, that is well proven. Very, very, very well proven in the research. So if that is the case, and we know that they're going to lose those fine motor skills at that level, then what we need to do is ensure that we know what it feels like to get to that point, because we need to know that we're about to make a mistake. And in order to do that, we need to ensure that we're able to know how our skills are or what our skills are like and at what point they will start to fail. And so the only way to do that is to put yourself under pressure, under stress, and see if you can find that fail point. Once you've done that, then you can say, okay, that bit is great. I'm happy with that. I'm really confident there. My system works well in this particular environment. My skill set works well in this environment. However, at this point, things start to fail. That's the point I need to train on. I can use an example of this. Recently, we did some work with some tactical medics who work in high threat environments, and they are extremely skilled in the use of tactical weapons. You know, these are the operators that go into those types of environments to deal with perpetrators. And what we see is that they're really quite comfortable, even though their stress levels are high. Yes, their respiratory rates are up, their HRV is up, etc. We can see that they are able to manage their skill set, their physical skills really well, even at a higher stress level, because they feel comfortable in that space. What we found was that once they were past the tactical point, let's say they've moved through a particular scene, they've now had to deploy their guns, they've perhaps, a perpetrator's been shot, etc. And now they're moving from tactical to medical. And now they're having to do things like, do a quick march assessment of the patient. They're assessing for life-threatening bleeds, for example, tensioning pneumothoraces, etc. They're finding those things, and now they're going, I know what I have to do. I have to decompress this chest. But at that point, they become indecisive. At that point, they start to redline. And at that point, their physical skills start to fail. And it's because they haven't had the ongoing practice in those particular things. So we're able to take a group like that and go, okay, cool, your tactical skills are great. You're all good at this particular thing. Your head's staying clear at this. But once we get to this point, things start to fail. We need to work on that. And now we give them an opportunity to work on that. And then they go away, and then they come back, and then we test them. And what do? We ratchet up the pressure. We find a similar pressure point as the last time, and we see if they fail again. And then we do that over and over and over until we start to see that fail point either disappear or at least be moved significantly down the bottleneck. Now, some of those things we can do by improving our systems. And it might be that we, something as simple as a primary survey, a DRABC type survey, or an MARCH type survey is easy to do, isn't it? Sitting here, like you and I right now, if I asked you to rattle off a DRABC, you could fire away, you'd give me a whole thing, you could give me a nice little sample history, beautiful, no worries at all. But if I'm asking you to do that while you're dodging someone that's, coming at you with a samurai sword, then things change. And so we have to get to the point where our systems are able to operate even when we're under threat, when we're under stress, because otherwise they will fail. And it's the same with our skills. It's all well and good to be, the world's best cannulator in an environment where the lights are always good, the veins are always popping, you've got plenty of time to set up, it's all well and, happy days. But we all know, from our time on road and even, students out there, when you get your opportunity to go out there, that they don't present like that. The patient's in pain, they keep moving their arm. They've probably got all sorts of weirdness going on. So they're not, they're pulling away. They may have some swelling in the limbs. So the veins aren't even, really palpable or visible. It's not the same. And so we need to be able to get our physical skills to the point where they become essentially automatic, autonomous, so that it reduces our cognitive load. Because if we're having to think about the physical skill, then we can't be thinking about the bigger picture. I always use the idea, I've said this to, my students over the years. Imagine when you first learnt to drive a car. That first day when you sat in there with mum, dad, uncle, auntie, whoever it was that got the short straw and had to teach you on the first day, and you're sitting there and they're sitting there as nervous as all hell. And, let's assume it was a manual and they've said to you, okay, push the clutch in. That's the one on the left-hand side. So that goes down. Okay, now the gear stick across left, search. Now check your mirrors. Now put your, and your brain is spinning, right, on that first day, and you drop the clutch, the whole thing bunny hops, and then you know get a bit embarrassed, and then eventually off you go, and you're driving down the road, and you know your mum, dad, cousin, uncle, whoever else goes, okay, indicate to turn left, and you turn on the windscreen wipers, and they come on, and then you panic and you freak out, and then you say, remember that?
Absolutely.
Remember that? Okay, so what about the last time you drove a car, Alex? Did you change the stereo? Did you probably chat to a friend? I hope you went on the phone, but you know what I mean. Were you probably having a conversation? You're probably sipping on a coffee. Were you doing all of that and all of those other things that we were just talking about?
Absolutely.
So how did you manage to do that? You're some kind of superhuman. How does that work?
You just adapt over time. You get used to it.
Yeah, those other skills, the clutch, the brake, the gears, the indicator, those sorts of things become autonomic, right? And once they become autonomic, they have a very low cognitive load. You don't have to think about them very hard. You can just do. Now, when you get to that point, you are able to start thinking about things like where you are on the road. How far ahead can you project? And this is an important one for our, you know, our paramedics out there thinking about, for example, your emergency driving. In order to be a good emergency code driver, you need to not only be able to drive, but you need to be able to free up the cognitive bandwidth to be able to be viewing the scene in front of you, thinking about all the changes that are occurring under lights and sirens. You're moving fast. You've probably got noise in the back, maybe with a patient and all the sorts of things that are happening there. And you're scanning ahead. You're scanning sideways. You're thinking about all of these things. Now, you can't do that if you're not a competent driver because you're focused on the driving. Yeah? It's the same thing with our clinical skills. If you're focused on changing the clutch, in this case, maybe completely focused on the cannulation, if you are so zeroed in on that skill that you can't think about anything else, then as soon as there's a change in the variation, as soon as there's an increase in stress, as soon as there's anything, then you're probably going to fail, or at least you're more likely to fail. And so in order to succeed, we need to get to the point where we free up our cognitive bandwidth to think. And that's where our practice and training comes in.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And even the past, you know, 5 weeks when I've moved over here and trying to get used to all the changes here, even a simple thing like, we'll go into the cannulation, the simple thing is the cannulas are different, which means you've got to change your technique. And for me, I was working in the ED prior to this and I was able to cannulate all day, every day. But that whole, you know, muscle memory of that skill was challenged and I had to change that. And so I really utilized our time in our induction period to just go through the motions of using these new cannulas. Even though I've cannulated before, I'm not a master at cannulating, but it was just the getting into that routine of, okay, this is exactly how it's done with these little cannulas. That muscle memory of just doing that skill has made a massive difference. So it's a simple
thing.
I love
that. Yeah. I love that, Alex. The key to that is that you recognized it. You didn't just assume that, oh, I've cannulated before, so I'm good. You could have done that, and you know, and people do. And so pat on the back to you. Like you recognized, hey, I've got a change in variables here. I've got a different cannula, which is going to require me to have a look at this. I need to have a look at whether or not I fit my skill. And that's what the best operators do. You know, they get to the point where they are just really comfortable with everything they're doing. So, you know, I did some work recently with some tactical guys, and what I loved was we introduced them to a new set of kit, a whole new bag, you know. So it was set up specifically for them to operate it in a tactical space. And everything is extremely quick and easy to access, et cetera, right? Well, but it was new to them. Now, they'd used all the different pieces of the kit before, but they'd used them in a different configuration and under a different level of stress. And what I found with those, and because these are the, you know, operators at the highest level, every single break we took, every time there was a lunch break, every time we had a coffee, whatever else, I would turn around and these, you know, operators, guys and girls, they'd be disassembling the kit. They'd be pulling it apart. Even though they'd seen everything in there 50 times, they would do it again. They'd pull it out. They'd go, okay, that's where those go. That's where that goes. That's where that goes. That's where that is. Okay, that's how that works. And they did that over and over and over again so that when we put them under pressure and we put them under some extreme levels of pressure, they didn't have to think about the, oh, where is the blue this or the green that or the this that. They just reach for it. And it allows them to keep that cognitive bandwidth free to think about the bigger picture stuff, like what's going on in my situational awareness space, what's happening in the tactical space, what's happening medically with my patient. You know, then you're able to start thinking about the heuristics of your patient's patho. You know, am I on the right track with my management? Is the management that I've implemented actually working, or have I buggered it up and it's all gone pear-shaped? You can't be doing those things if you're solely focused on what is the green cannula or what is the blue, whatever, you know, OP. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So again, it's our training. That's where it comes back to.
Absolutely. And I think if we're putting it into a sense of sort of, you know, paramedic side of things, it's that truck check every morning. It's like getting hands on and tactile and, you know, opening up the cupboards and seeing where everything is, opening up their bag, seeing where everything is, because, you know, you don't want to get into that situation where you need something in a really serious situation and you can't find it. And then your stress levels have gone up, you know, tenfold and you're stressed out to the max. Now, I think if we're trying to bring it back to the whole before arriving on scene, how do you sort of mentally prepare yourself from your own experience and from what you've seen in others? How do you prepare yourself mentally for going into that job? It may seem chaotic on the screen, or it might be something, you know, that you do all the time.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is to have done the prep beforehand. You know, all those things that we've already just talked about for the last sort of 20 minutes, half hour, if you've done all that, then you have a really solid toolkit to reach into. If you haven't done that, then the cupboard is bare. And it's at about that point that you start questioning maybe some of your life choices and maybe what have I done and how did I get myself into this? And this is a stupid idea and I'm pretty happy to flip burgers at McDonald's from now on. And that's fine too. So if you've done the prep, you're already on the way. But then the next thing is that you should be anxious. And this is the other thing to now start putting in your kit bag. It's okay to feel stressed. It's okay to feel anxious. It's okay to be a bit worried. Because if you're not, you're a little bit psychopathic. If you're not worried about a big job that you haven't seen before and you're not really sure about the variables, then there's something probably not quite right with what's going on, because you should be. Because you should be now starting to think about your differentials. You should be starting now to think about, okay, what are the types of skills that I may need to employ in this particular thing? And if you're not feeling that, then, you know, maybe there's something to address there. But for my mind, start to prepare. Okay, what are some of the variables? What are the most likely variables? We can't think about everything. We can't guess everything, but we can certainly start to pick some of the low-hanging fruit. You know, if there's a respiratory job, then what kinds of pathophysiology produces the respiratory type presentations that we're looking at? If that is the case, then what kind of pharmacology do I have in my kit bag that I might be reaching for? Have a quick think through those. Again, you're starting to process all these things. But more importantly than anything else, it's about your system. All right. So you're starting to build in your head. Okay, when I'm approaching them, when I get there, this is how I'm going to go about things. As I approach the scene, I'm going to think about my situational awareness. I'm going to pay close attention to the danger, to myself, to my partner, to anybody else around me. I'm going to survey the scene. I'm going to ensure that everything's happy there. Once I've done that, I'm going to start looking at the response of my patient. How do they appear to me? Are they consciously alert? Are they registering my presence? If that's happening, great, I'm going to go down this route. If they're not, then I'm starting to think this. And you're just role-playing that out in your head so that you've already got a bit of a plan and you've got a number of different plans that you can divert on. Once you've done that, then the other thing to consider is that cognitive pause, that moment in time, whether or not it's a purely psychological pause or whether or not you actually do it physically, that you take a moment and you just center yourself. And it sounds, I know occasionally it can sound a bit woo-woo, but there is tons of evidence now to suggest that something as simple as a couple of conscious breaths, whatever that might look like, whether or not it's a box breathing exercise, whether or not it's, you know, some Wim Hof-y stuff or whatever you want to do, I don't care what it is. In fact, I don't even really think it's that important what it is, but it's more so that you're doing it. And it's what it is it's that opportunity for your brain and your body to reconnect. All right. It's this opportunity for you to go, okay, I'm here now. I've got my kit. I can see the scene. I'm going to take a moment. I'm comfortable with my scene. I'm going to have a chat to my partner if I've got one available to me. This is what I'm thinking. How are you feeling? Yeah, I'm good. Okay, let's go. Now, we start stepping into our system. We start utilizing our system. Again, it's about training. If we've trained that system and we've trained it over and over and over again, and I used to say to, you know, my students at uni, you know, become the greatest friend of your pillow at home that you could possibly could. That pillow should be treated 50,000 times. They should be, you know, treated for every type of illness known to mankind under every different scenario. If you've got a giant teddy bear, whatever, you know, whatever it is, just treat them over and over and over again. But then also start to really consciously build in that cognitive pause. The idea of what I like to do now for me, particularly in an environment where I find myself, perhaps overwhelmed. I had a really interesting case on the weekend where we had a mountain biker who took a dive down a very steep embankment and had a dislocated pelvis. So, you know, a pretty significant injury in the middle of nowhere. We were very remote. And, you know, we got there. It was very clear he was conscious, alert. We knew that his airway was open because he was screaming like a banshee, as you would expect with a, you know, fractured pelvis, dislocated pelvis. So it was like, okay, take a moment. What have I got in front of me? Here's my patient. What's the biggest issue I have right now? Was it ABC? No, it's not. I can see him. His airway's open. He's clearly breathing. There's no obvious, you know, hemorrhage. He's clearly got a BP. He's clearly got a pulse. What is my biggest concern right now? We're 50 meters down a bank. It's thick tree cover. There's no way a helicopter's coming in here. There's only one way up, and it's back up the way we came. There's no way to manage this patient where we are. We need to move this patient now. So, it, you know, our priority list changed from sort of a DRABC clinical to we need to extricate so that we can manage, which meant, mate, I'm really sorry. This is going to hurt. We're going to get you out of here. We're going to get you out of here as quickly as we can, and then we're going to start managing you. Okay, then move. Yeah. So that cognitive pause allows you to take in everything that you've got around you, utilize the systems that you've got, understand the environment that you have, prioritize, and then move. And if you find yourself, and again, this is why I went back to the start of our conversation about learning what it feels like to redline. If you start to feel like I'm redlining again, I'm losing control of that cognitive thought, it's getting away on me, it's snowballing, you know, I'm becoming cloudy in my judgments. Okay, I recognize that. What do I need to do? I need to take a moment. And so what I'm trying to do with myself these days is I'm actually taking a physical one step back. I take a step back. I physically move myself to create a physical and then psychological break. A breath, and then I go again. Yeah? So something that simple. Now, I'm not saying that everyone else has to do that. But what people have to do is they have to come up with a system that that works for them, that allows them to recognize when they're going to start making poor decisions or the system's getting away on them, etc., so that they're able to reset and then go again.
That's really good. That's a lot of information, but I think it's a fantastic overview of pretty much before you get there and then when you get there. And I really like, you know, your story there of having to extricate. And I was just thinking as you were saying that, I was like, how on earth did you extricate that person?
Carried him up the bank on our back. Yeah, it was pretty brutal. But we needed to get him out of there. There was no sort of nice way to do it. Sometimes paramedicine's not nice. You know, sometimes what we do is not pretty. You know, I know that you spent your time in ED, and it was interesting that you mentioned before that, you know, you could cannulate all day in ED, but you think about ED, you know, like they're up on a bed at a nice height. You've got some really good lighting. You know, you get a chance to lay out all your kit nice and neatly. It's a little bit different 50 meters down a bank in a dirt hole with, you know, up against a tree, etc. You just sometimes paramedicine is just what it is. You know, we can't always, I know, you know, at uni you like to train things perfectly and it all comes out beautifully in the wash, but that's not the reality of the world in which we operate. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, and that's okay.
Oh, God, no. Everyone here in the UK has very steep, short stairs that are, yeah, it's a nightmare.
Yep.
So I guess what we've gone through is really great, and I guess just covering some points that I made that sort of help, I guess, is, yeah, like you said, either writing it down or thinking it out loud, talking to your mentors on placement as a student about differentials, you know, thinking about your pharmacology, as you said, those protocols for particular situations you may be going to, and sort of thinking about some management plans. Either, yeah, like I said, either writing it down or talking to your mentors is a fantastic way to do it. But the thing that I've had to find, I've reminded myself a lot, is that things aren't always as they seem. So like something will come through on the Terrafix or whatever you're using, the MDT, and then you get there and it's completely different. And I think that for me has changed a lot of things in the way that I prepare myself for a job as well, because now I'm trying not to get overly stressed, because I go, okay, this is what it will be if it's worst case scenario. I know how to deal with that. I can go through a cardiac arrest. This is the best case scenario. How will I manage that? And then kind of think about all the murky things in the middle.
Yeah, I completely agree. Do you know what's really interesting too is I think it's funny you say worst case scenario, cardiac arrest. Let's be honest.
It's not the worst case scenario.
It's really not the worst case scenario. Most cardiac arrests in general, unless it's a traumatic arrest and there's some kind of crazy weirdness going on, are pretty kind of systematic, right? It's the sort of thing that, you know, you've probably trained for over and over at uni or wherever you're doing your study. And they are fairly systematic. You tend to kind of go through the numbers, and sometimes when you go through the numbers, it works and sometimes it doesn't. And that's okay. And look, the reality of someone in cardiac arrest is you can't really make it worse because they're already in cardiac arrest. I think it's the ones that are sort of teetering on the edge, you know, when your management makes a big difference, you know, like you've got a really sick cardiogenic APO or something like that. And if you manage it well, you can bring them right back from the brink. But if you manage it poorly, you can push them over the other side. Those ones to me are the ones that, you know, really test us cognitively and really put you under the pump. I completely agree with you around the idea of not buying in too much to what you've got. And again, I really love what you said, which was, you know, what will be, and it will be, because it's going to be the job regardless of whether or not you turn up or not. It's going to be what it is. And that's an important thing to hold on to as well. So if we can keep, you know, our focus on the process rather than the outcome. And this is probably one of my big takeaways, I guess, from this conversation is it needs to be process driven. If your management, if your diagnosis, if your assessment and your management are process driven, so you're following the processes, you're following your systems, you're utilizing the equipment that you have available to you, and that you're applying the pathophysiology that you understand and how that relates to the pharmacology, et cetera. If you're following that process, then the outcome will look after itself. Now, sometimes that outcome will be really positive, sometimes it will be neutral, and occasionally it will be negative. What we want to try and do is make those negative outcomes as infrequent as possible. We can't completely remove failure. It's not possible. It can't be done, but we want to limit it, obviously. So if we focus on our systems, if we focus on the process of how do I get the information so that I'm from my patient and from the scene, how do I process that information through my systems and apply it using things like my understanding of pathophysiology, pharmacology, anatomy, physiology, etc., then I'm going to give myself the best chance of making the best decisions and therefore coming out with the best outcome. If I'm focused on the outcome, if I'm focused on what's going to happen, then I'm far more likely to fail. And I'll use another really simple analogy. There's been a lot of research done in the space for penalty spot kicks in football. So soccer, for those of us in this part of the world, right? Where they've done tons and tons and tons of work on eye tracking and decision making and where they look and when they look and et cetera. And what they have clearly shown is that those players who go through the process without worrying about where the ball is going to end up, but rather focus on what they are doing at that moment in time, are far more successful and consistently successful than the person or the players that are concerned about where the ball is going to end up. And we're the same.
That's really interesting. That's a bit mind-blowing, but I really like that. And I think it makes sense, though, because I think, I don't know, but like when you're at uni, all the scenarios, most of the time you get the happily ever after of the patient lives and you've saved them from the brink of death and you get your cannulas in first go. Everything just happens and it works. But then I think if you come out into the real world and you're expecting that to happen with everything you do, then you're not giving yourself that opportunity to adapt to when things don't go right. When you do miss that cannula, you then don't go, oh my God, like everything's, you know, down the drain now. And so I think if you're just, like you said, focusing on that process and focusing on the systems that you're going through rather than some outcome of the patient's going to, you know, be this perfectly, beautifully packaged, saved from the brink of death type thing. I mean, if you're being realistic about it and just focusing on what you can do then and there, it makes a bit of a bigger difference. I don't know.
No, it really does. And if we go back to our example from earlier, which was the cannulation example, you know, if you focus on the process, if you focus on, okay, do I need to cannulate? Have I got consent? Great. Which is the best location for this particular cannulation? What type of thing am I going to need to put through it? So is it a small vein? Is it a big vein? That will determine whether or not I need a small needle or a big needle. Okay. I've now, I've applied my tourniquet. I've looked for where I need to go. I found the best option for me in terms of the vein that I want to use. And now I take my time. I lay out each of the pieces of equipment that I'm going to use in the order that I'm going to use them. And then I rehearse that in my head. Right, I haven't even thought about the cannula or the cannulation itself yet. I've just been focused on the process of getting all my equipment together, and in doing that, I've reduced my cognitive load because I'm worrying about each individual thing. Do I have the alka wipe? Do I have the bung? Do I have the ink? Yeah, cool, excellent. Okay, now back to that vein. Oh, look, that's plumped up nicely. Okay, now I can go through. Okay, what is the process of good cannulation technique? This is the angle at which I want to approach, keeping the skin close, etc. But if you focus on each of those individual parts, then you are. No one gets every cannula, and anyone who tells you that they get every cannula is making it up, right? But if you do go through the process and you do follow things like that, and I'm sure I'd be really interested to hear your take on this, then you are far more likely to succeed. And like I said, it's okay to fail because we all do, but we just need to limit those failures. And in limiting those failures, we're actually going to reduce our stress, which was kind of the whole point of this conversation in the first place.
Absolutely. No, I definitely agree with that. And that's how I cannulate. That's how I've always set it up. And I think, if you, again, it comes back to that training perspective. If you're doing that in training, you're setting up exactly how you would in real life in training. It's reducing that cognitive overload or that it's just making it into muscle memory so that when you are doing it, you're able to ask questions at the same time as cannulating, or you're able to do other things and just not feel as overwhelmed. So I think, yeah, definitely there's a massive link between doing things in such a systematic way, practicing that systematic way in your training, and getting uncomfortable, being uncomfortable and giving things a go, in order to better set yourself up for success. And I like how, coming back to that point at the start, you can't avoid sort of being anxious or stressed before a job, but you can definitely prepare yourself and set yourself up for success. I think when it comes to sort of the things you can control, like your systematic approach and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, I think we can wrap it up there, really. I mean, unless there's any
cool main points you think we've missed. Look, mate, you know me. I could talk about this stuff all day. but we won't bore your listeners. So I just think people need to be okay with being, I love that, being comfortable, being uncomfortable. Just put yourself out there, practice, put yourself under stress, practice your systems, take a moment, have a cognitive pause, regather yourself, go again, be okay with failing, and then focus on the process, not the outcome. And you're going to be okay. You know what? You're going to be okay. And it's all right to not be the best or the greatest every time, all the time. And if there's one thing that, you know, you learn after spending many, many years in the world of medicine and around people in medicine is that there is always something more to learn. There is, it's an iceberg. You know, what we know is that little bit sticking out the top, and then underneath it just goes on and on and on. There is always more. So it's okay to go, do you know what? I don't know this, or I don't get this. Can someone here help me? Yeah. And with, you know, one of my favorite sayings is a rising tide lifts all ships. One of the coolest things to see is to watch, great clinicians who are excellent at their job, turning around to someone else and going, hey, man, you're really good at this. Can you help me with this? I want to get better. And that's what the best operators do, whether or not it's paramedics or tactical or anything else. The best operators are the ones who are always looking to get better. They're always looking to improve, and they're okay with parking their ego, putting their ego in their back pocket and going, hey, cool, Alex, you seem really good at this. Can you help me out? Because I got nothing. And then again, like I said, focusing on the process, not the outcome. And it's going to be, you're going to be okay.
I love that. I think that's a fantastic way to finish off. Thank you so much for jumping on today. I really appreciate it. And I think, this has definitely been a fantastic conversation. I hope a lot of people get everything or get everything out of it, because it was an awesome, awesome chat. So thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Alex. It's a real pleasure. And it's nice to have you back on the air too. We missed you while you were away.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.